Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
This week on the PR Moment podcast, in the latest of our Life Stories series, I'm pleased to welcome founder and CEO of Lansons, Tony Langham. Lansons is one of the UK's largest independent PR consultancies, with a fee income of circa £11 million and over 100 employees. The business was founded in 1989 by Tony and his now wife, Claire Parsons. Tony, welcome to the PR Moment podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Just tell me about the series of events that led to you launching Lansons, because it's quite an interesting story.
Well, through the 80s, we'd had ideas that we would form a business, a group of us, for quite some time. We worked at an organisation called Dew Rogerson, advised on privatisations. Claire and I worked together. Several other people were involved. Claire left, went to another company. We carried on talking. And Dew Rogerson acquired her company called Quigley's.
So she couldn't get away.
It was news to us. And we had a quick decision because some clients had followed Claire to Quigley's. Didn't necessarily want to follow her back. She spied an opportunity, did a good deal with one of those clients, British and Commonwealth Merchant Bank, set up in their offices, and we just decided to do it. It took 2 minutes to decide, plus the time to take out the necessary credit cards and take some money out of the mortgage. And Claire said I could join her when I'd won a client. And when I persuaded Churchill Insurance to come over, I joined and we formed Lansons.
Fine. And what stage of your life were you at this point?
Stage? Well, I was 28, I think.
Right. Okay. So you weren't married, is that right? I'm just trying to work out, because I always think the propensity to risk increases once you've got, I don't know, mortgages, kids, all that type of stuff.
But we had a mortgage, because we remortgaged the flat. So
sure.
So we then had 100% mortgage, which was possible in those crazy days.
Right.
And we were together, but we weren't married.
Okay. And so did you see it as a risk? Because from when I hear your tale, it sounds like that's pretty risky, Tony. But the way you talk about it, you don't seem, I don't know if it's just hindsight that you think that was very risky, or whether at the time you were, you know, the adrenaline was running a little bit.
Well, we were doing it together, I think, is the key. We were both making the same decision. We both judged that the worst that could happen was that we lost everything we had. We would go bankrupt, but both of us would be able to get a job again because we had faith in us. So that was the downside. And the upside was it would be a success and we'd have our own business, which is what we wanted.
Sure. So you maxed out both your Amex cards and extended your mortgages, and that gave you enough to pay for yourselves. You didn't, or did you hire people when you started out?
Well, we got new ones, because Amex then, I remember, had a card with a 10,000 limit, right. But you had to be in a job to have one, so we had to get them first.
Gotcha.
Obviously before we resigned.
I resigned. Okay.
So that was the key moment. The same with the remortgage.
Right.
And then Claire started with fee income. Although she had to wait for it to be paid, obviously. And I came over when I had a client, but there's obviously a lag. So it was cash flow, effectively.
Right.
And that was all the cash flow we needed.
But you did it with some other people? That's what was quite cheap.
Initially, Claire on her own,
right. Me
coming over at night to help. Then the two of us, and then we took two other people on for the sort of formal launch in November.
Right. And who was that?
So Maria Darby, who stayed at Lansons for 13 years, now executive coach. Lots of people will know through her career at several places, Barclays, Tolkien, et cetera, et cetera. And Annie Lewis, who was who ran everything that wasn't consultancy related.
Okay. And we've already talked about Claire. She later became your wife. What's it like running a business with your wife for nearly 30 years?
Well, it's great, obviously, because we're still married and we're still at Lansons and it's all cool. I always say that it depends which way around you do it. In the 80s, the employment law wasn't the same as now, and our company had a rule that if anyone had a relationship, they would fire the less important person. So therefore, the relationship was secret. So we were used to having a secret relationship. So now it's easy to do business, disagree, which we do often, and not bring the relationship into work. Straightforward.
Okay.
But the other way around, I suspect, if you're with someone and you think of having a business and your only relationship is a personal relationship and you take that into work, I suspect that's a bit harder.
Okay. Yeah, because you've got to refine those ground rules within a new context, in essence.
And find a way of suppressing your relationship behaviour as well.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's amazing, just to think how much times have changed, isn't it?
Well, it was full circle now because we've got love clauses, of course. So you could argue that, you know, the things that we hear of, love clauses being introduced at certain companies.
I don't even know what love clause is.
Effectively, you're not allowed to have relationships in the office.
Is that right?
So, yeah, so there are some of those appearing. I've heard of them in city companies. Yeah.
I'm amazed that's illegal, but apparently it is. Right, and Lanson's is one of those companies that... Well, go on, just talk to me about the growth of Lanson's as a story over the last 30 years, because it's followed a bit of a pattern, hasn't it?
Well, it was... we were young, obviously, so it was a financial services-focused Marcoms public relations agency in 1989, and 30 years later... It's completely different, but it still does all of those things. It's just that they're a smaller part of the business. And the things that have changed are, I would say we're a full-service reputation management agency with a fast-growing content marketing capability. I mean, it's completely different skills. We're involved in mergers and acquisitions. We've built a very successful change in employee engagement practice, and we're inside companies the fastest-growing part of our business. More than 10% of our business is outside the UK, and that's increasing all the time. And our corporate consultancy grows and grows, and financial services is now less than 70% of the business. So I guess, and in between there have been steps up and flats and other things. But that's where we are now.
Sure. Mm. And when we talked before we recorded the show, you were just talking about there was a pattern that you'd identified sort of for investment and then growth. In a sort of as the business grew in sort of steps, just talk us through how that works in reality. I suppose.
Yeah, it's just my thought. I mean, we're a business owned by the people that work in it. Claire and I have sold half of the business to colleagues, so we own around 50% between the two of us. 35 colleagues own the other 50% between them. We have always said to them that it's a business that is profitable, is determined to be profitable, and pays dividends. You know, I see lots of companies that build up the capital value but don't actually throw off any cash because they have debt. We don't have any debt. So the business has always been determined to make profit. The way you make profit, obviously, is to match investment with money coming in and not to have too much capacity. So we tend to go on growth spurts. Towards the end of the growth spurt, we're very, very lean and efficient. We're very profitable. But the new business pipeline starts to slow down. We expand our business, invest in the business. The profits go down. The business tends to flatten for a while, and then it goes off on another growth spurt if we've got the investments right. And so you have these periods of lower profitability going into higher profitability, back to lower into higher. And it goes up, then it goes flat, then it goes up, then it goes flat.
And as you're going through that that step, if you like, you're aware of it, are you? So you think, okay, I've invested here. That should give us a good run, assuming those investments are in the right place for that in the next 3 years, 5 years, whatever that time frame may be.
You're subject to the outside world.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the outside world intervenes and there's nothing you can do. So for us, the dot-com crash of 2000, the financial crash of 2008-9, and then now the delayed spending uncertainty over Brexit, they're all periods that lead to a flat. But almost whatever we do, and we're investing to stay still at the moment, but investing for the next growth period, which I'm sure will come, but also hedging our bets by looking more internationally than just the UK.
Right. And... So just talk to me about what have you done within Lanson's now? Not that I know you've done some investment external of Lanson's, but what types of things have you foreseen coming that and made investments that have worked? And I guess conversely, are there a few that haven't worked as well?
Yeah, primarily we're a people business, so the main form of investment is people. Not all the people work, so I certainly don't want to mention the ones that haven't worked.
We should say, I used to work at Lanson's, so I was probably one of them. But,
you were one of the ones that worked, and has worked even better.
I don't know about sense. That, but yeah.
The things that have worked have been making sure that we have an industry-leading public affairs government advice capability, which we have. I think we must be close to industry leadership on employee engagement, change in employee engagement. Right. We'd still be the best agency at financial services issues management in that area. And I'd say we're pretty close to the top in terms of crisis management for an agency that is in the national news, has complicated issues, and needs a wide skill set to help it out of those. I'd say we're excellent in all those areas. And they've all come from investments in people and people that have stayed. And the ones that haven't worked yet... wider investment in healthcare hasn't worked yet, although we have healthcare clients, but I think in future we will crack that one. We haven't quite built the portfolio of listed clients that I'd like to, but we each year goes by, we do more and more activity. You know, we worked on the first IPO of 2018, IntegraFin, and that side of our business is growing, but isn't there yet. And in the content marketing space, where we've decided more recently that yes, now is the time to push for a fit for purpose sort of function in that area. We're just heavily investing in that area at the moment. That's one of the big investments now.
Okay. It's quite interesting, just as an observer of Lansons, and I don't think this is a point that's specific only to Lansons, but you've, on some of those examples you've given, you've clearly made a strategic decision to build practices in those areas. And it's not necessarily the first hire or the second hire that's worked, but you've kept going at it, and in the end, you've found the right person. Is that? Would you agree with that, or is that?
Or sometimes people.
Yeah,
I think we have themes. Yeah. The way I like to look at it, we have themes of things we know we want to do, and then when we find the right person, people, then we do them more heavily than if we don't.
Right.
So we have themes of things that we're looking to do, and we prioritise some over others, but they're all still there.
Right.
And
I suppose what I meant was that. Sometimes people say to me, oh, we just met the right person and went for it. But yeah. It feels a bit more strategic than you with you guys than that, isn't it?
Yeah, mix of the two. Okay. Mix of the two. Okay. I mean, it is strategic, but if something comes along, you know, there are plenty of agencies that I mean, at the moment, what would you call them? There's no demand for sort of agency brands at the moment. You know, the traditional buyers, WPP, Omnicom, are reducing their brands, so there's no demand for brands. So if an agency isn't particularly profitable, there's not really an exit.
No.
So there's going to be some solutions out there. Okay. And there's lots of consolidation. And yeah. There's going to be lots of consolidation. If we see a consolidation play that works for us and works for them, then I wouldn't count it out in the next 2 years.
Okay. Now, you touched on it a moment ago, and let's just talk about the employee ownership element of Lansons, because it's, you know, there's a few people in the PR sector who do that now. I suspect Lansons has been doing it longer than anyone. As you said, you and Claire now own 50% of the business.
Roughly.
And 35 or so members of staff own the rest.
Yeah.
Why did you decide that an employee ownership model was right for you, and why has it worked?
Well, the first one's really easy. It's the way we think businesses should be. So we do believe in employees sharing in the profits, subject to obviously the investments people have made. These kind of businesses rely on quality people, so it there's a benefit for the company. But it's the way we think businesses should be. Okay. So it's you know, we wanted to have a business that we thought was the right kind of business. We do lots of other things along those lines, you know, like a contribution to society, you know, having a charity that we commit to, being carbon neutral, being able to house a fantastic theatre company in our offices called High Tide, a wonderful organisation that put on, you know, plays, professionally produced plays for first-time writers and have made several people's careers. I mean, we can make that contribution, and that's something we wanted to do. And the other thing was to develop an ownership model that was fair. So people do buy into the model, but we value the business at about a quarter to a fifth of what it's really worth. We use the same formula when they leave. So if the business has grown when they've been an owner and they leave, they go away with more money than they've had, and they've had dividends from profits in the meantime. So we make it attractive financially for people. And hopefully it we say to them, the more business you create for us, the more of the business you can own. So the largest owners, the people that have made most money for us, you know, Laura Hastings, Rebecca Mayo, I mean, they own the largest portions of the company outside of Claire and I.
Okay.
And then the people that have been with us a long time, Helen Proud, Henrietta Guthrie, similarly.
Okay. So it's one that basically incentivizes people to grow the business, in a sense, for their benefit and the business's benefit is simplistically what we're saying.
Well, it incentivizes some, and it incentivizes some other people less. But if it's something that means something to you, I think, I think there are plenty of people who just want to be an employee, and I think that's perfectly fine. Okay. You know, we have no
problem.
So
some people you offer it, and they don't want to do it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Some people don't. It's not 100% accepted, and people do have to invest. You know, we completely accept that it might not be the right time for someone. For us, we just offer it again, and we it makes no difference to our opinion of them at all.
Right. Okay. Now, entrepreneurship seems to be a theme within Lanson's history. Have you encouraged that? Because it's something that pretty much every company says, oh, we're really entrepreneurial. And it's almost become something you expect businesses to say. But what does it actually mean? How does it manifest itself within a business, do you think?
Well, I think it means feeling empowered to do something and doing something. I've almost always thought that anything that happens in life or in business, the planning thought side of it is roughly 3 to 5%, and the actual doing of it is 97 to 95%. And so if someone's talking and thinking and planning and for 50% of the time, then they're not entrepreneurial in my book.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is the ability to make decisions and commit to them and follow them. Plenty of people can't take decisions. Every single entrepreneurial decision has an upside and a downside.
Yes.
So it's a matter of judging that the probability of the upside is greater than the downside, making the decision and then implementing it. And I think that's what it's about. And so, within the business, it's not a senior-only thing. I mean, we have people in our business
almost conversely true, I suspect.
Yeah. Well, someone can just say, I think I know this politician, and I think this politician will be very interested to talk to our clients. And if that's what someone thinks, and they can arrange that, and then they come to me and say they're coming in on April the 12th, that's fantastic, because then we can turn the right kind of clients out to see them. And that's entrepreneurialism to me.
Right.
In the same way that, for an example for me would be, went through, our finance, our joint managing director, who also is finance director, Stuart Graham, when he introduced me to James and Joe, who formed Hope and Glory. I think within 5 minutes, I thought they were fantastic people that would have one of the most successful consumer PR agencies in the country within a short period of time. We should make them, and I decided to make them a good offer of support, what I thought would be better than any other offer of support they'd get, because I just thought they were great people and they would do it, and I just went for it. And that's something that didn't really take me very long to decide to do.
We'll come on to that in a minute, but it's quite interesting just looking at the nuts and bolts of entrepreneurialism, because you defined it quite nicely there. It doesn't always have to be a brand new revenue stream. It doesn't always have to be a new client. It can be a much smaller thing, like a visit of a politician or an event or something like that. And you create that environment for people to come up with new thinking and new ways to do things, which is, I suppose, a self-perpetuating circle of things. If people feel confident to do that, they're more likely to come up with different, bigger, potentially better ideas.
Absolutely. Okay. And it could be a service. And it could be one of those things that everyone talks about, but nobody quite get sorted. For instance, we should have a state-of-the-art evaluation package that runs across all of our clients and works for our clients. Every agency talks about that for years, months, weeks, days. If someone just goes away with a group of three people and does it, that's entrepreneurialism to me.
Absolutely.
And that's what I mean.
I think they might have to go away for quite a while for that particular question. They may never come back.
In my career, about 35 years and counting, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you touched on it. You invested in Hope and Glory, which I suspect a lot of listeners to this podcast will be aware of. You also launched a research firm called Opinion. And just to say, it's worth pointing out, isn't it, that the combined turnovers of those two businesses are, I think, getting on towards the turnover of Lanson's. So, with hindsight, that was an important and successful play that you made there.
Yeah.
So they were pretty good bets, weren't they? How come do you think they've done so well?
Well, as I've said, Hope and Glory was just great people with great background, and the help they needed to short-circuit their growth was incubation, to be part of something bigger very briefly, the meeting rooms, the infrastructure, the RFP assistance that gave them a sort of a supercharger launch. And then from that, they've needed nothing else from us, and they're fantastic.
Right.
A fantastic independent company. It's just a shareholding. We are nothing to do with their success from that initial part. Opinion slightly different in that setting up a research company is more capital intensive to actually make it work. I mean, I'm a believer that in research, you know, really, if you don't own at least a good portion of your own panel, and you're always buying in panel, paying the people you interview, it's going to be more difficult to make money. So you need to own your own panel. You need to have fantastic people. That required greater investment. It was fortunate that Lansons was and is a big commissioner of market research. So at the time, YouGov was the top dog. So we were able to set up a very humble rival to YouGov that offered, you know, a great service, streamlined service, competitively, and that got the company onto the launch pad.
Right.
And that was when Lansons was very important to the success of Opinium. Since those days, and that's probably 7 years ago now, Opinium is now a completely independent business run by a fantastic chief executive, James Endersby. I mean, okay, so we as a group of people recruited him, but he owns an increasing part of the company as he makes it more successful, and it has flown the nest, so to speak. The key element there was us having the backing to get it onto the launch pad, and then us selecting the right chief executive and giving them the freedom to make it work.
Because I think that's an interesting example of where you clearly had the right strategy, but it took you a while to find James, didn't it? And there were lots of other good things happened before that point.
Yeah.
But that was absolutely critical part of the growth, I suppose. So I suppose do you put that down to being an independent firm who could keep investing until that, I don't know about seminal moment, but that moment when the business took off happened?
Possibly. I think we always had faith I mean, I had knowledge of research. My first job was in the political social research team at Moray, now Ipsos. I came with a very strong view that the rigor and the public scrutiny and the straightforward massive publicity value of being involved in political polling and politicians and social issues was worth doing. So I made sure the company did that always.
Yeah.
So because it always had a bigger name, and today has a bigger name, I think, because of that, than it's...
Well, they got a few predictions right as well, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Which also helped.
Absolutely. not least Brexit, of course,
being
one of the two companies that got that right. And that was being one of the main provers that online research and online panels, if done properly, are just as accurate as any other form of research.
Okay. Now, slightly awkward question, might give me a kick, but there must have been a few businesses that you've tried and that have failed.
Yeah, I think you've given me space for the two successes. the one that was least successful was our foray into an internet business where £400,000 disappeared down a black hole.
Really?
And very little of that is left in a business called Mindful Money. Although I have to say, and we're still open to offers. And Mindful Money is a great name and a great domain name. So I guess if nothing else, we still have a domain name. But yes, that one we made lots of wrong decisions. But I think our batting average is pretty good.
Yeah, I suppose that's what was behind my question though, is that you're not going to get everything right, are you? And I think there's a danger that, especially it's a British thing that sometimes you think, oh, they didn't get that right. We can be too cautious in our approach sometimes, and it's interesting that you've invested in a portfolio of stuff and they haven't all worked out.
Yeah, way too cautious. I think we can be way too cautious, and I do slightly worry that we're getting more cautious
without doubt.
And I think that's not healthy in all walks of life. I think it's harder to get money to borrow. It's harder to find backers on a reasonable level, and it's harder to find people that want to, inverted commas, risk their life on a business where really it's not as much as a risk as it seems, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Well, you'll know, obviously, because you've done it.
Yeah, well, do you know, it did make me think about PR Moment. Bear in mind that I have, when I launched PR Moment, I had a lot of contacts, not as many as I do now. But, you know, every single launch advertiser I had was a US company. And that was purely, you know, bear in mind, I must have asked a lot of people to come on board, advertising, commercially, and all that sort of stuff. But everyone that did come on board was US owned. I suspect that can't have been coincidence.
That's really
just too big a risk for the Brits.
Well, you prove them wrong.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, proving. So tell me about your book. Like all good people these days, you've written a book. And it's Reputation Management, The Future of Corporate Communications and Public Relations. Why did you decide to write a book?
Well, I'd always wanted to. It was one of my themes. But the simple reason for the why now answer is the PRCA and ECO asked me to.
Okay.
As part of their practice guide series. So along with a few other authors, as part of the first series of practice guides. So they offered me the Reputation Management book. I jumped at it because it's something I wanted to do. Because I've got things I want to say about our business, and I've got a very clear view on where our industry is going and where our business is going.
So go on then. Where are we
That's
going?
That's a good next question. I passionately believe that we're fundamental to business success, in that reputation is fundamental to business success. I'm not caught up on whether people call something reputation or brand or trust. Or image or all of those things. I think we all know what the factor is that enhances business success. When one organization speaks, you're more likely to listen to it than another. One organization talks to government, it listens to one more than another. One launches a product in a new area, you're more inclined to try it. Whatever that is, that elixir of business success, which I call reputation, is something that we in our industry have a huge part in building, protecting, developing. But we don't really get paid for it, and we don't really get remunerated for it, and we do need to.
Well, you've done all right, but that's your point, is it? One of your points is that we're not charging enough for it, is that, well, as a sector?
Well, we're not defining what we do in the best way. I think, unfortunately, while public relations in its purest sense and relations with all of your publics does encompass what we do, the shortened version, PR, get me some PR, it's time to talk to the PR person, I need a PR agency, is not a high value, high margin thing in British business in the same way that call McKinsey, or actually call a strategic communications geopolitical agency or leading M&A consultancy is. And we need to redefine what we do as reputation management.
Right.
I think the consumer side of the business has already gone. I think consumer PR doesn't exist anymore. I think there are just marketing agencies, and there are marketing agencies that are slightly more media relations than others, or there are advertising agencies that are slightly more advertising, but they're all marketing agencies producing a range of content to me. And the other side of the business hasn't yet sorted itself properly, but will become defined as reputation management.
Has something changed? Because I suppose that one thing I'd put back to you is that maybe hasn't it always been like that? It's always been, and I mean, I apologise for the cliche, but a broad church of practice with, I guess, corporate communications, strategic communications on one side versus brand communications on the other. And you've always had a spectrum of work across those areas. Or do you think the differences between one part of the sector to the other have increased?
Well, those things have always existed and always will exist because I'm a buyer into the quote that the future's unevenly distributed, like wealth, but it's all around us. So some organisations look like the future, some organisations look like the past, and everything's on a spectrum.
Right.
I think what's changed is that. The previous world of lots of silos, people consuming information in one sphere but not bleeding into another sphere, or Westminster being a slightly different bubble, a trade negotiation or a political discussion or a board meeting being confidential, all those things have completely changed. And I don't think any of us can really, when we say content, I mean, all of us are mixing media buying, advertising.
Mm. Numerous touch points.
Writing.
Content,
so all of us are mixing those things. So I think the silos have gone, or should have gone, but haven't yet. They're going. And when they go, organisations will have two functions: reputation management, marketing, and they'll be led by a data function. There won't particularly be any other functions, and the biggest agencies will be in the same categories because you don't really need those silos anymore.
Okay. And just talk to me. Was it hard going writing a book? Did you find it? Was it long late nights, early mornings? Was it a particularly high discipline process?
Yeah, it was a period of 4.5 hours sleep with mornings, evenings, weekends, and holidays on the book, and then doing my job in the time in between.
How long did it take you to write?
Well, the quarter of the book that I wrote almost all of it in 4 weeks. But the 75% of the book, which consists of 8 interviews and then contributions from a total of 81 other people, that took 6 months to organise and deliver, because I contacted 250 people around the world. I've got 39 case studies from 27 different countries. I've got 27 essays from people in all walks of life, but not that many in our industry. I talk to people outside our industry, and then I've got 7 really fantastic interviews with people that make a difference. And I'm, you know, the bits that I'm really proud of, persuading top author Anthony Horowitz who writes the Fleming family James Bond novels now, to write Why We Still Love James Bond in an Age When He's Anachronistic. You know, interviewing another fantastic global selling author, Kate Moss, on how she's a quiet revolutionary with how she mixes her personal feminism with being a best-selling author. Talking to Martin Lewis about reputation and his paranoia about reputation. And I wanted to talk about purpose, so I talked to the Duke of Richmond and Gordon, who owns the Goodwood Estate, about their brand values and their values and purpose at Goodwood.
Right.
Sport and integrity. I talked to Winfried, who runs the Hong Kong Jockey Club. And so I was able to get those people to input. Kamal Ahmed, I talked to about the issues around reputation and being of mixed race. And Helena Morrissey wrote a fantastic essay, Dame Helena Morrissey, I should say, wrote a fantastic essay about the issues of women and reputation. So by doing all of that, I think that was just a tremendous thing for me. I mean, it was time-consuming and that six-month period was intense because all of those have to, sign the right forms, and I had a team of people at Lancers helping. It was just fantastic fun to do that, actually.
So what have you done? So you've got a body of case studies, you've got a body of essays from senior people, and have you made some conclusions based on the back of those case studies and the essays, or have you sort of written your opinion and then referred to
I've those? Written my polemic and then made a distinction between other people's perspectives.
Okay.
So I haven't shoehorned them into my view, and I haven't crowdsourced my view particularly. I've just given their perspectives on parts of the world.
So so in that sense, their perspective backs up, or you need to read the whole book to gain an understanding of what's the well.
Yeah. Okay. So to pick that apart, when it didn't take me long to say to define reputation, because I already went through the fact that I blurred the lines. But I also, one of the other joys, of course, was spending a month reading all of the best books in the area. So I spent a month reading the best books, and I looked at what they'd done and what could be added to them, and the fantastic definitions of reputation. You know, US professor John Dawley has a great definition of what reputation is. So I use, with his permission, obviously, I used his definition, and getting to know him was fantastic during the course of the book. It's really important to cut through the complexity of reputation. Rupert Younger at Finsbury and David Waller at FTI wrote a fantastic book, The Reputation Game, on character reputation and capability reputation, if I just use that definition. So I when I was writing those things and my views on why reputation management isn't happening, I would then punctuate that with other people's views.
Okay.
So the one review of the book from PR Place came out today, said it all made logical sense and was a fairly logical narrative. So
perfect.
To take their word for it.
Perfect. you've run a PR agency for 30-odd years. Looking forward, what trends do you see around the future of the PR agency model?
I think I've touched on them. I think that that the best agencies will be reputation, will position themselves as reputation management agencies. I think organizations will manage their reputation holistically. They will have an external partner. There will be a dashboard of reputation evaluation assessment. There will be a reputation plan. We'll be comfortable with influencing organizations' behavior as well as just their communication. And the organizations that get into that space will be the most successful in a corporate space.
Right.
And that will encompass what we think of as M&A agencies, strategic corporate communications agencies, geopolitical agencies. They will all be differing versions of that. And I think I chart in one part of the book how they're incorporating reputation into their own lexicon of language. I think Brunswick still has its critical business, your support for chief executives in moments of critical business decision making. Tenaya Blue Rubicon still focuses on the chief exec a lot, but I think their language of all of us is moving towards reputation.
Okay.
And I think that's a key trend which will change the recruits that we're taking in.
And that's one side of the market, yeah. And then the other side is on. As I understand, your premises be on the brand marketing.
There will be marketing agencies,
right.
And I think in 10 years' time, I don't think people will be able to say whether. Let's look at the best in our field. I don't know if people will be able to look at Golin and say that was a PR agency. I mean, I think I would look at them and say they're a marketing agency, and I think that. That dignifies the amazing progress they've made. I think the same thing of Weber Shandwick.
Well, Golin have just tried to redefine themselves again as a PR firm, but it's it's an interesting discussion point.
Yes, I don't think I'm not a fan of that turn because I think the buyers will be buying. Well, the buyers will be buying. I've called it marketing, but the buyers will be buying brand a differential reputational brand value. Customers acquired cheaply, and then a perception of excellence, and they'll be buying those things, and they will think of those things as they'll be buying them as a marketing function, and they'll be thinking of the agencies that supply them as differing types of marketing agency.
Okay, so that journey to integration will mean that the in essence agencies have to offer an integrated play. And therefore become defined by that.
Well, I think so. The only counter to that is the organisation that says the client organisation in this case that says I don't want everyone to see the whole picture. Which actually a lot of bankers think about their own bank that they don't want McKinsey to see their whole organisation. They don't want Goldman Sachs to see their whole organisation. Nor do they want an outside supplier to see their whole organisation. In that case, they will holistically manage their reputation. And they can easily buy services. So they could buy services to fit into their holistic picture. So the specialists, the very tightly defined monoline specialists that survive will be bought by organisations that are doing the integrated piece without the outside supplier being integrated. Right. But then you're on the end of a... I think you're then on the end of becoming a price-reliant business or a commodity.
Is there a school of thought that says... the buyers of consultancy services don't necessarily want a one-stop shop, and I know that's not particularly why that's not driving at your end goal, but it's kind of what it will become. What they actually want is the best specialist that they can afford, and does that not therefore would that therefore not mean that there may well end up being more of a market around these different services than you think might happen?
All those things will carry on. It won't be black and white. I think they want the best results delivered efficiently and for an easy life. I don't think anyone is glorying in having 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 outside suppliers.
No.
And I think we're accepting that in our industry, aren't we? We're also accepting that, well, the larger players seem to be accepting that our brand names aren't that important. I mean, if you can throw away Burson Mostella and Conan Wolf and say we're BCW without the largest advertising budget to actually tell everyone you're BCW, you're effectively saying our histories and our brand names aren't worth that much.
Yes, you never know to what extent that is a reflection of the market or those individual companies and where they are at that particular moment in time. But yes, I can see what you're saying, that they, it doesn't suggest that they valued the Burson brand, WPP valued the Burson brand particularly highly, does it?
It doesn't suggest that. And also, but I wouldn't be assuming that WPP don't understand their customers. So I'd be saying they do understand their customers, and their customers are happy with it that way.
Well, I mean, in I don't think this is particularly relevant just to, or just about public relations, is it? But in the end, it's about the quality of the person, the consultant, if you like. So presumably Lansons is only as good as the people it employs to an extent. Do your customers buy because you're Lansons, or do they buy from you because of the quality of your people? Does it get down to that?
I think it's a mixture of the two. Okay. I think we believe it's the people, and we will only get chosen if the people have the right chemistry, ability, just likability and believability, credibility, I think. So we believe it's the people, but it is also important, I think, that it's Lansons. I mean, I think the fact that we know where we're going and we have extra insight, you know, you hope that we have extra tools that are different, better than other people. So yeah, you hope that the organisation is adding that as well. And okay. I think we, you know, the fact that we've been successful and been involved in lots of successful client situations over 30 years, and we have continuity in that period, it should gives reassurance and helps as well.
Okay. Now, which agency is Stuart Marr at the moment? Who would you say is on the up?
I'm probably going to go to some of the ones I've mentioned. I think I know that, you know, I mean, I mean, in Lansons, I mean, I work in the space of organisations with significant issues, or governments with significant issues. So I, you know, I'm drawn to, you know, the fantastic business that Alan Parker's built at Brunswick is obviously exemplary. I mean, you have to admire that from an economic point of view, in terms of the model. I mean, people are paid properly that work there, which is really good, and rewarded properly. So, and their seat at the board table is admirable. Clearly, Finsbury would fit into the same category. The most exciting large company must be Tenaya Blue Rubicon of the last few years. So, I would have to say that I admire those. On the marketing side, you know, I like what Matt's done at Golin, and I think Hope and Glory are fantastic.
Okay.
But then, you know, whenever I look at the at new companies, I mean, despite the fact, you know, earlier we said maybe we're losing a bit of entrepreneurialism, some of the newer companies are great in the marketing space.
That's interesting.
I really get excited by them.
Yeah, it's interesting with London, isn't it? It keeps on throwing up entrepreneurial consultancy firm, marketing consultancy, communications consultancy firms that seem to do well and grow quickly, I guess, by doing good work. So it remains quite an exciting market to observe.
Oh, absolutely, and to work in, and we just need to make sure that we all run economic models that mean we can continue to attract the quality of people. That mean we can do the right quality of work. I mean, if the industry has a danger, it's that it's running itself on too low a margin at the moment, and it's competing too aggressively. But London's a crowded market.
Sure, and what you're suggesting there is that impacts the extent to which you're able to pay your people and invest in the business.
Yeah, and also you have to. While I'd love what I do, and I would never do anything else, you have to be aware, you know, if you take the graduate pool, you know, you have to be aware of the, you know, what does our industry pay versus a law firm, versus a management consultancy, versus an investment bank. I mean, you have to be aware of the differential, and the differential has increased in my working life.
Right.
So we haven't done that right.
Okay.
And we, you know, we haven't. And that's where I go back to where I start from, in that, you know, we are helping create and protect great reputations, but we've been paid as what they think is a PR agency.
Okay. Brilliant. Tony Langham, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.